Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is classical music essayist Lucy Kaplan. She's assistant professor of music at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and we're talking about her new book, Dreaming in Ensemble, How Black Artists Transformed American Opera. Lucy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
This is a history that remains, for the most part, for most people, sort of a lost or forgotten history. I certainly knew very little of anything about Black Americans in opera from before, like, the sort of more contemporary era, people like Leontine Price and all those people. But this early history was just completely new to me. How did you gravitate towards the subject? What inspired you?
A great question. I think there are two different ways that I can answer that. One is a story of finding a specific piece of music in an archive. When I was an undergraduate student, actually, I was looking through various library collections to find something to write a paper about and came across an opera called Tom Tom by a woman named
Shirley Graham. That became my most, I really wanted to listen to Tom Tom.
Yeah, me too. I wish I could have listened to the whole thing when I first came across it because it is just such a fascinating piece. It's this kind of epic history of Black diasporic history from pre-modern Africa all the way up to the 1930s when it was written. And, you know, I was totally fascinated by this work. Here was this piece of opera. It was by an African-American woman. It told a story that was really unlike the stories we typically hear in opera. And I just wanted to know everything about it. And as I came to know the piece, I also became curious about the world that made it possible, the world that inspired it. Why was this woman, Shirley Graham, writing opera in the 1930s about Black diasporic history? And why was this a history that I had never heard about? So I became really curious about that piece, and it really sparked what became this, decade-long project to write this book and to think about more broadly the place of Black composers and performers and critics and listeners in this world of American opera.
And it's an interesting story, and it's not an easy one to have teased out all the different pieces, I imagine.
Yeah, it's a story that was really complex to put together because, you know, as you might imagine, there's no one place that you can go to find all the materials related to this story. I really started looking all over the place to find little snippets of information about Black artists in opera. What I found was that newspapers in the Black press and magazines were an especially incredible source of information. And, you know, I'm so grateful to the people who did all the work to digitize a lot of these collections. So you can go look for newspapers like the Chicago Defender or the Indianapolis Freeman or the New York Age. And they have all these tiny little snippets of information and articles about performances, about composers, about artists. So by looking through all of those, really kind of piece by piece, I was able to start piecing together this broader cultural history of what people were up to on a daily basis over the whole first half of the 20th century.
What's fascinating to me is there's this whole, like when it first really started out, which is post-bellum, so during the era of Jim Crow, there's this whole interesting history that I never would... So for me, this time period is, I have to ask myself, why would Black American audiences be attracted to this form of music that is predominantly European and white? And it would seem to be very off-putting. But the attraction was what? Why were they interested? Why were people at that time interested in opera?
It's a great question. Opera has this really fascinating kind of cultural history in terms of its place in our broader cultural hierarchy or kind of cultural life. in the 19th century, and this will probably surprise a lot of people, opera was really much more a part of American popular culture. It was something you could hear, you know, all over the place. There were these traveling opera companies that would take the train all around the country and perform at little local small town opera houses, usually performing works translated in English. It was really this much more democratic cultural form. And it's only around the time of the Gilded Age that opera really gets institutionalized in places like the Metropolitan Opera House or these kind of big, large-scale urban venues that are catering primarily to elite upper-class audiences. So it has this complexity to its cultural place. And so I think, you know, that's one important thing to keep in mind is that what we associate with opera now, this kind of elitism and fancy kind of cultural status, has not always been part of how it works. And so I think there was a sense among Black communities that there was room to continue kind of thinking through and remaking opera's cultural meaning.
You use a term, and I love this term, and I want you to just elaborate on its meaning. Black operatic counterculture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a term that I really wanted to emphasize in the book to show how Black artists were engaging with opera in this really collective way and in this way that was really about creating a distinct cultural formation. So I think that sometimes we think of African Americans in opera in terms of specific people, whether that's like Marian Anderson, Christ, you know, kind of exceptional individuals who are so wonderful and so amazing that they transcend the broader challenges of the art form to rise to fame. And I think that's something that happens, but it doesn't tell the whole story. So this term counterculture is meant to emphasize that opera is something that people were doing collectively and in community with each other. And also that in doing this, these artists were doing much more than kind of reacting or responding to the whiteness and often white supremacy in the art form. They were really thinking about ways to reclaim or remake opera as a space for advancing African-American culture.
There's a lot of people in your book I was not familiar with, and that's why I thank you for writing this book. But let's talk about a few of them. Sure. Lawrence Freeman, he composed over 20 operas, and we're talking, in the late 1800s?
That's right. Freeman is one of my favorite people in the book. I find his story so moving and so inspiring. He's actually one of the people who you can see his face on the cover. He is a composer who was born in Cleveland in the mid-19th century and totally self-educated, self-taught musician, and becomes fascinated by opera and by this art form. He hears a Wagner opera, and that's what really gets him excited.
Of all the operas to become inspired by. So, yeah, and that was one of the things about him, too. He was into opera in the grand style.
Totally. Yeah, very kind of old-fashioned in a lot of ways in his aesthetic taste. And he becomes totally fascinated by this art form and really devotes his whole life to writing and composing opera. He writes his first one in the early 1890s. And continues writing all the way up until his death in 1954.
Wow.
You know, 6 decades of composing opera. It's really amazing.
Now, what's interesting, and this is a theme that comes through your book, yeah, he's writing operas, but he's not incorporating necessarily situations that would be relevant to Black Americans at that time in America.
That's right. He has a really wide sense of what kinds of subject material are appropriate for him as an African-American composer in a way that I find really remarkable. his very first opera, a piece called The Martyr, set in ancient Egypt. And it's this really kind of dramatic old school story about a hero and a religious conversion and a love story, and everyone dies at the end. It's very, very opera. But you know, it's not a story about African-American life per se. It's not offering audiences kind of a window into Black experience. Instead, it's doing something from his own imagination and his own creative mind. So that's really fascinating to me, that he was so capacious in his sense of what kinds of subjects were available to him as an operatic composer. He was really bold in his ability to travel all around the globe, quite literally, for inspiration.
Not only was ancient Egypt, but he also did Ethiopia. He had several of his operas had African themes. I think of Nada, and there was an African kraal. So he did incorporate, especially later, African themes. But as far as contemporary Black experience in America, that was not. But they were these big operas, like these huge, full-blown. Were they performed enough, or were they only performed a few times?
So that was a really perennial struggle that Freeman faced with getting his operas performed. His first opera, The Martyr, was performed in Denver, actually, in 1893. The cast was pretty much all amateurs. One was literally his roommate, who was a cook, who he kind of recruited to come sing in the opera. And as a result, he spent a lot of time kind of training singers to perform opera. He desperately wanted his music to be performed. He later formed an opera company. His son was the business manager. And fun fact, he named his son after one of his operas, which I think is amazing.
That's
not
cool.
The other way around. And he did get a few performances of these works, especially during the Harlem Renaissance, when there was this kind of broader interest in African-American culture. And later in his life, he had one of them performed in a kind of concert version at Carnegie Hall, actually. But he struggled throughout his life with the fact that most of these operas would never be performed and would never be heard.
And that's true for many of these composers.
That's right.
Composed between sort of the Harlem Renaissance and postbellum. I mean, there were all these operas written, and a lot of them did not see a wide performance at all, let alone Carnegie Hall or at the Met. That sort of seemed to be the last bastion that they had to sort of break down in order to get it performed. The thing that was amazing about, and you include pictures of this in their book, we were talking about a full-fledged opera. He had costumes designed by Amos Dixon, and they're beautiful. They're really incredible. And so you really feel like we're at a loss that we're not able to see this opera.
Yeah, it really, you know, it is a shame. It was something really challenging in the writing of this book, is the fact that we can't see these operas. And I'm really grateful for that visual record, for things like the costume designs, and like his, even the scores to his operas are so beautiful, and such kind of works of art in themselves. So those give me, and I hope readers, you know, some kind of access into the world of his imagination. But I think performance is a real priority. And there's been one performance of a Freeman opera. It was about 10 years ago at this point, in New York, and it was amazing. And I only hope that there are more music that really deserves a wider audience.
Now, there was the composers, but there was also people who formed opera companies. Or schools that offered private lessons in opera all along. Like, for instance, Theodore Drury founded an opera company of African-American artists in 1900. And they did things like productions of Bizet's Carmen in 1900. And those went along. How are they attracting students? The thing that always amazes me is, jazz is going on at this time. And as you talk about a little bit in the book, a lot of people just sort of said opera. I'm going to jump on the jazz bandwagon because it's more music that I can relate to. How did opera answer that? How did opera maintain its attraction?
Yeah, it's a great question. So someone like Theodore Drury is super fascinating. He, as you said, forms this opera company in New York in 1900, and he's recruiting people from all over the place to come be part of this company. Some of them are singers with experience kind of on popular stages or musical theater stages. Some of them are interested in classical music. And even in this world that I think is so dominated by early musical theater and then by jazz and by ragtime, there is always this interest among artists in opera and in seeing what this kind of weird, different art form can offer them.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is classical music essayist Lucy Kaplan. She's assistant professor of music at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And we're talking about her new book. It is so fascinating. Dreaming in Ensemble, How Black Artists Transformed American Opera. And as you also write about in the book, there was a whole rise in black opera criticism.
That's right. The tradition of opera criticism was one of my favorite things that I found in this research. Just this amazing, perceptive, thoughtful writing about the art form that you find in black newspapers and magazines during this time period. I learned so much from those kinds of sources about how people were listening to opera, not just performing and composing it, but what it meant to go to a performance or to listen to it or to kind of theorize its place in the broader cultural world.
Well, there are people like Sylvester Russell, who was just an amazing critic. And one of the important things is he rejected assumed authority of white critics. He definitely sort of carved his own space there in black opera criticism.
That's right. Russell was this fantastic character. I think he would have been a great person to get to know. He was really kind of self-confident and maybe a little grouchy in his perspective. He writes this criticism about opera and about a lot of other art forms where he really tells people what he thinks. So he will tell the performers not only what he thought was good and bad about their performance, but also what they should do differently the next time.
Wow. He sounded like a pretty harsh critic. He was a tough critic.
He's a very tough critic, and he's proud of being a tough critic. You know, something he writes about in his work is that a lot of critics he thinks are too nice.
Yeah.
They just want to praise everybody and say, you know, great job, good job trying to perform this work, to do this. And he says, no, not so fast. if we want to really make a real kind of flourishing tradition of black opera and of black art more broadly, we need to make it as good as it can be. And he saw his role as a critic in shaping this tradition for the future.
Now, we're going to run out of time before I get to talk about all the things I want to talk about, but let's talk about Scott Joplin's Treemonisha, because that's a fascinating opera. He was unable to find a publisher in his day to even publish the score. It never reached the stage, but it's now, in the last couple of decades, it's been performed.
That's right. The story of Treemonisha is a really rich one. It was Joplin's second opera, actually. He wrote another one that sadly has been lost. And he was really committed to this project, to this idea of writing an opera about a young woman in the 1880s who is trying to uplift her community. And he desperately wanted it to be performed, but during his lifetime, kind of the best he could do was self-publishing the score and getting together a group of people to do essentially a run-through of the show with a piano in a rented space. So not the, you know, grand opera house that we imagine. And that was the situation throughout his life. It was only in the 1970s that companies began really taking up Treemonisha as something to perform. And there have been, since then, a bunch of different orchestrations of it and versions of it and imaginings of it. As part of the research for the book, I got the chance to go hear one of these in St. Louis a few years ago and speak with a lot of the artists who were part of it, which was really special. Just being able to hear from folks who are working in opera today about what it's like to perform this piece, to engage with this piece, was really meaningful for kind of bringing this historical story up into the present.
There's so many interesting points in your book. I want to talk about the problem of Aida. because as things progress in time, black opera singers are starting to be inserted into opera, yet they're typecast. And there's so much racial typecasting. And a classic example of that is Aida. There's a great quote in your book from Jesse Norman, who commented in 1973, "People look at me and say Aida." And so they were relegated to the only roles where normally they would have used blackface, but because it's a black character in the opera, they felt that they were safe using a black performer.
That's right. So Aida becomes a really central thread in the book and in the story of black opera in the early 20th century. Because it's this character who is already racially marked in the score, it's seen as a little bit safer, I think, than a Wagner role or something else that is either unmarked or kind of associated with whiteness. So it's seen as a place where these performers can have a space in opera without necessarily disrupting the broader racial politics of the art form too broadly.
But then there's an opera like Tom Tom, and you really devote a lot of space to in the book, and it just really made me want to see the entire opera. It was produced during the Harlem Renaissance. It was the first opera by a black woman and produced by a major opera company. And you detail a lot of what goes on in that opera. It sounds fascinating, great.
Yeah, it's an incredible piece. I've had the opportunity to work with a few fantastic singers to perform little excerpts from it.
So yeah, yeah.
There's some work out there, and there are a number of people who've expressed interest in putting on a full production. So, fingers crossed that that.
Oh, that would be amazing. Yeah. I would love to, because that's the first time that you really feel like opera is starting to deal with things that are happening in the black communities, or at least resonating to the concerns and the ideas of the black community.
That's right. It's a piece that
It's revolutionary. At least that's the way you describe it. I mean, it's a really important piece of music.
Mm-hmm. It really is. It tells a story about African-American history that I think is really different from other stories that were being told at the time, and different from a lot of stories that are being told today. It takes this really kind of global perspective, thinking about the relationship between Africa and America. It thinks about the relationship between past and present. And musically, it's just amazing. It has, everything in it, from African folk song that Shirley Graham heard, to kind of contemporary jazz, to spirituals, to almost like WC-inspired kind of modernist composition. So it has every musical flavor you could imagine, and she puts them together in a way that works just incredibly well.
We're almost out of time, but I have to say, Shirley Graham sounds like a fascinating person in and of herself.
Yeah, she is. She was an artist and activist and intellectual, and she's better known today because in 1951 she married W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yep.
But I always try not to lead with that
because
she had a really rich life in her own right.
And she traveled. She really traveled too. She loved Paris.
She did. She spent a lot of time in Paris in the 20s, and that was really foundational to her musical life and to her intellectual life. She met a whole bunch of other black artists and intellectuals there who became lifelong friends.
We're almost out of time, but I want to say that one of the fascinating things about your book is, yes, you pay attention to the singers and to the composers, but you also pay attention to the Black people that actually worked in the opera. In other words, they were part and parcel of how the opera got to function. Even though they may not have been able to be invited in as an audience member, they may take tickets or they may do this and that, and they got to hear a lot of opera.
Yeah, I felt like it was really important to me to include those stories of people who are part of the kind of ecosystem of opera, even if they're not on stage.
They're the people that are making opera work.
Exactly. And, you know, we know that opera is so complex and expensive and rich and has all these different components to it. And that requires a lot of labor and work to make that possible. So I really wanted to highlight people who are part of the world of the opera house beyond what you see if you just go in for the show and see what's happening on stage.
And again, some of those people are fascinating, like Julian Bagley, the de facto archivist of opera. And there are people who did opera translations, and the list just goes on. And that's all just part and parcel of this book. This book covers all the bases. It's amazing. My guest tonight is classical music essayist Lucy Kaplan. She's assistant professor of music at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And we're talking about her new book, Dreaming in Ensemble, How Black Artists Transformed American Opera. Lucy, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really wonderful to speak with you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.